So we were talking about population dynamics. And we discussed, we already presented some very simple and what I would say paradigmatic models of either population biology or ecology. So we talked about logistic growth. We then discussed competition, two species competition. And then we talked about two species symbiosis.
I have another topic in mind.
Sure.
The inverse Ising model?
The inverse Ising model.
Having the correlation functions and then finding the relationship between the spins.
Oh my God. That's an incredibly hard topic.
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
really interesting.
It is really interesting. I would say that that's also a topic I have no knowledge of. That's number one. And number two, I'm not sure that it's something that I could like squeeze into like of the order of one lecture. I'm talking about like sort of a one lecture overview. But anyway, that's a very interesting topic. And I know nothing. So I apologize. I have my limitations. And so the last thing that I want to present here was prey-predator models. One thing I want to say before I write down any more equations is that all of this is predicated on the notion of the mean field type assumption. So you'll notice that when I'm writing down these equations, they only involved densities and nothing else. There was no diffusion. There was no, there was no spatial variation. So all of these models are with the assumption of like perfect, what's called the perfect mixing assumption. Namely, that the density at any given point in space is the same as the density everywhere else. And so we can write down essentially what are called zero-dimensional models because there's no space variable. And under that assumption, we can write down, differential equations for the behavior of the global densities, and we can then try and solve them. So what's actually kind of a state-of-the-art problem is like when you include spatial variation. So once you allow for spatial variation, the density, then one has to include the transport as well as the interaction that's going on. And this turns out to be an extremely hard problem that's still kind of state of the art. So if you're interested in mathematical ecology, that's kind of where the state of the art lives. So I just wanted to emphasize that because I didn't say that last time, that we're talking in the terms of the perfect mixing assumption. So we did these three models. So let's now talk about prey-predator. And I wrote down the equations and I didn't do any analysis of them. So let's write them down again and then do some analysis. So my prey-predator models are based on like two species, A and B. And so we're going to write down equations for how these change with time. And I can think of the A as the prey and the B as the predators. And so the prey, in the most simple-minded model, we just say, well, the prey are like something like rabbits. So they reproduce like rabbits. So they do something like this. But they're preyed upon by foxes. And so when a rabbit and a fox meet with a rate that happens proportional to the product of the densities, because it takes two to tango, then that causes a decrease in the number of rabbits. And in principle, one could put coefficients here, whatever, depending on like the relative growth rate and the relative rate of meeting. But let me put the coefficients here equal to one just for simplicity. But if you want to put coefficients here, anything, you're free to do that. And similarly for the prey, I would say, well, if foxes have no rabbits to prey upon, they're going to disappear exponentially in time. They just starve to death. But when a prey and a predator meet, a rabbit and a fox meet, that corresponds to that the fox is now, full and can reproduce. And so you increase the density of foxes when you have this interaction between rabbits and foxes. So this is what's also known as the Lotka-Volterra model. And it has a it's a very famous model in population biology. And in fact, it was first thought up by a guy named Alfred Lotka in the 1920s when people were looking at fish catches in the Adriatic Sea and noticed that the fish catches did an oscillatory behavior over many years of cycling. And it turns out that also in northern Canada, back in the days of the Hudson's Bay Company, and they were looking at trapping of animals for furs, they also find like an oscillatory behavior of the number of animals that would catch as a function of time. And so from these two observations, Volterra basically came up with a model of this type. And it's the minimalist model you can write down that allows for the possibility of oscillatory behavior in the densities of the prey and the predator. So let's look at this thing and see what we can learn. So again, let's do the same program as before. We're going to find the null clines, find the fixed points, and then infer the global behavior. So let's first of all look at the null clines. So the null cline A dot equals 0. That implies that we have either A, so we have A minus AB equals 0. And so from this, we're going to get either A equals 0 or B equals 1. Those are the two conditions for the null clines for A dot equals 0. It turns out that the first null cline is kind of a trivial thing, and it's not going to really tell us very much. But this one turns out to be non-trivial. And similarly for B dot equals 0, Gesundheit, so we're going to have minus B plus AB equals 0. And so from this, we'll get either B equals 0 or A equals 1. So let's look now in the AB plane. And so here is the line B equals 1. Here is the line A equals 1. So the line B equals 1 is where A dot is equal to 0. So on one side of this thing, A will change in one direction. It'll change in the other direction. So let's try and figure that out. So if I'm sitting at B equals 1, so then my equation is A. If B is bigger than 1, then this is more term is more negative, and so it means that A dot is negative. So it says that just above the flow, so let's go further away, the flow is negative, whereas below it, the flow is positive. So that's the A dot equals 0 null cline, and so A dot goes to 0 right on the line, and then it's negative here, positive here. Similarly, over here, let's do the same thing. So for this null cline, if A is bigger than 1, that means that it's going to be positive flow for B and negative flow that away. So that's the behavior of the null clines. And now the second part of this is now that we found the null clines, we can find the fixed points by where the null clines intersect, because that means that both A and B don't change. And so clearly there's a fixed point here. And now let's try and figure out the flow locally about the fixed point, and then from that try and infer the global flow. So in this quadrant, we have that the flow is up because we're to the right of this null cline, and it's to the right because we're below the other null cline. So the flow looks something like this. In this quadrant, we have flow to the left and flow up, so it's doing something like that. In this quadrant, we have flow down and flow to the left. And in this quadrant, we have flow, which is still down, but now going to the right. So it looks like we're going around and around in a circle. So it turns out this fixed point that we have here is not a usual either stable or unstable fixed point. It could be a stable spiral. The flow could spiral in, or it could spiral out, or it could be a center where there's no average flow into this. And it turns out that for the Lotka-Volterra model, it has a very special symmetry. This is actually a center. So in fact, the flow lines are looking something like this. And that requires a lot more effort to show that it takes a little bit more effort to show that in fact this is a center. So in fact, the Lotka-Volterra model, and part of the reason that it was like studied so much is that it has a conservation law hidden inside of it. And because of this conservation law, this is a center. So let me show you the conservation law because it's kind of cool. So if I stare at these equations, you know, it's like when you're faced with like systems of nonlinear equations, like in principle, there's no systematic way of solving them. And you have to try and for each system, try and figure out some kind of way to get into the problem. It's sort of like doing a crossword puzzle, like trying to figure out the clue somehow. And in this case, there's an important clue because if I look at the A dot equation, it's linear in A, and the B dot equation is linear in B. So it suggests, why not factor out the A and see what else is left over? So if we factor out the A, let me take the A and put it on the left-hand side. So I'll have A dot over A, which is nothing more than derivative of log A. So we can write the log of the LV equations, I can write in this form. I can write a log of A dot is equal to 1 minus B. And similarly, log of B dot, dividing through by the B, I'll have equal to minus 1 plus A. So log A dot plus log B dot is equal to A minus, I'll add these up, and I'll get A minus B. But then if you just stare at these equations, let's look at the sum of these equations, A dot plus B dot. Well, this term cancels, and then just have A minus B. So over here, I can write A dot plus B dot is also equal to A minus B. So if I subtract these two things, I will get that log, and now let me write log of A plus log of B is just log AB, the whole thing dot, minus A plus B dot equal to zero. This is what's known as a conservation law because something does not depend on the time. This quantity is time independent. And because of the existence of this conservation law, it means that the orbits have to close because if I'm somewhere on this orbit where this quantity will have some value, since it's not changing, if I go around the circle, I have to be at the same point on the orbit. And so this means that there are closed orbits. So the implication is closed orbits. And this is very much similar to what happens in classical mechanics. You know, when you learn about planetary orbits, there is conservation of angular momentum, and so it says that all orbits lie in a plane. But then you can say, well, so why are the orbits of the planets closed ellipses? And, you know, if you solve, you'll find, yes, you get closed ellipses or actually conic sections are the solutions to like equations of motion. But it turns out there's a hidden conservation law called the Runge-Lenz vector. And because the Runge-Lenz vector is conserved, it means that the orbits are closed loops. So similarly here, we have this conservation law that tells us that the orbits are closed loops. So thing is that it's very easy to get seduced by the Lotka-Volterra model because it's so simple and has all this beautiful conservation. Yes?
Yeah. Maybe just notation. Where is the second dot exactly? Does it belong to the A or the B? Or?
It's the dot is on the quantity log of AB.
Oh, okay. The second term is also for A plus B.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's a whole thing. A plus B dot. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. What was I saying? I was saying it's very easy to get seduced by the Lotka-Volterra model because of the conservation law. I kind of fell into that trap, but beware, the Lotka-Volterra model is extremely special. It doesn't include self-regulation and all kinds of other natural terms that you might want to put in, such as, for example, self-regulation of the rabbits, self-regulation of the foxes. And once you do that, this conservation law is lost. And it turns out that this orbit, instead of being like a center, now turns into a stable spiral. So let me show you again. If I could have the screen, I want to show you just like what the orbits look like for this Luckow-Otero type model. Thank you.
This is eight dots.
So hopefully something's going to happen. Yeah, question.
Yeah, maybe another question. What
sure.
does self-regularization mean in the case of rabbits and foxes?
So that means, like, for example, a minus b squared term, that like the rabbits are competing with themselves. If there's too many rabbits, they fight for the grass, and then. So that's why I'm saying quadratic negative terms are what are called self-regulation terms.
Okay, and is there a physical intuition why that breaks the conservation law?
No, it's just that the conservation law is very special because of the form of the equations. Yes.
So how can we know that constraints implies the closed orbit?
How do I know what?
The constraint gives a closed orbit.
Well, no, the point is that there's a conservation law. So that quantity is conserved. And so it means that at any orbit that you have to have, that combination of variables has to stay constant.
It can be a line. There is no reason for it. Should be a closed
one. Well, no, but the point is that because the locally near the fixed point, we have like rotation happening here. Because of that fact and the existence of the conservation law, it says that these orbits have to close on themselves.
Pardon me?
Right. Yeah. Anyway, so here is the flow diagram for the Luckow-Otero model. You see there's a little E way up there that's equal to zero. So E is like, I did this with a self-regulation term on the rabbits, and so I've set it equal to zero. And you see that there's this nice looking center around 1, 1, and if you zoomed in on this, you'd see it's like beautiful circles, and it gets a little bit more distorted as you go further away, but that's the existence of a center. And then if I add a little bit of self-regulation to the rabbits, here maybe I should show you what the equation is. The equation is this. So it's, so x is like the rabbit. So without the e term, it's x minus xy, which is like a minus ab. And then for the foxes, it's just the usual Luckow-Otero. But then I have this minus ex, so there's a minus rabbit squared term. And so when I add a little bit of self-regulation, this nice closed orbit will change into a spiral. So you can see now it's clearly spiraling in. And so this is now a stable fixed point, but it's called a stable center. So if I do a local stability analysis about the fixed point, I would see that it have oscillatory approach to the fixed point. And as you increase the self-regulation, then it becomes more and more obvious that that's what's happening. And so that's the basic dynamics of this Luckow-Otero-like model. Yes.
For the one where e equals zero, there's a conservation law. Like we know that sorry to nitpick on this point, but
sure.
We know that right around the center is doing the circular thing. What sort of conditions would be necessary in order for that to like be broken and things to go off to infinity, like farther away from it?
There's a thing called the Poincaré-Bendixson theorem that sort of says that, you know, if you find a curve in space such that all the flow is going into this curve, then there's no way out, basically. So, you know, the point here is that if I have like what's here, a stable center, there's somewhere that's got to be a curve such that everything inside this curve has to come in and there's no way out. Yeah, I mean, three dimensions, you can have this, but not in two. Your question.
Is there a characteristic time scale to get to the center of the orbit?
Yeah, I mean, so the thing is that what we have not done here is we haven't done like a careful analysis of this, but, you know, if this is a course in dynamical systems theory, the one thing which is missing is that we'd say, okay, what we have to do is take our equations and look very close to the fixed point. Close to the fixed point, the deviation from, look at terms which involve deviation from the fixed point, and there'll be terms that are linear and quadratic and higher order. But close to the fixed point, all we have to do is worry about the linear terms. And so we have like a 2x2 matrix equation. We just have to look at the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of that matrix equation. We'll have either exponential flow in, exponential deviation, or we'll have some kind of rotation about the fixed point, either with, you know, shrinking or expanding or staying at the same level. So that would be like, if I was teaching course in dynamical systems, that would be the next thing I would teach. And that would tell you then how to analytically look more precisely at what's happening at a fixed point. Yeah.
Will these lines always point towards the fixed point, or is it possible that the arrows point away from the fixed point and the system wants to go up?
So the point here is that, and again, this is part of like a dynamical systems theory course, which is that you have like a linear matrix equation, what's happening near the fixed point, and you have to look at the eigenvalues. And the eigenvalues can be both real and less than one, which means you have convergence in all directions. One eigenvalue can be less than one. One can be larger than one, which means you have a saddle point. Two directions it flows in, two directions it flows out. They could both be bigger than one, in which case you have divergence. They could both be complex, they're necessarily complex conjugates with a amplitude which is less than one, which means you'll have stable spiral, or they could be amplitude bigger than one, which means you're diverging away. So those are all the possibilities for the linearized stability analysis, and that will then tell you everything you want to know about, you know, like quantitatively what's happening. But the picture that I'm telling you here is just qualitative, but that's the full calc. That's the full categorization of fixed points in two dimensions. Yes?
Maybe this is like a silly question, but I was thinking, as you change from like the setup with the orbits to the setup with the spirals, you kind of have like a phase transition. So I was wondering like if there's like some sort of scale invariance where like if you zoom in, there's still a spiral and like the spiral never...
Yeah, no. I would say that it's not scale invariance in the sense that... you know, because there's this exponential approach, like if the magnitude of the eigenvectors is less than one, that means that the, you know, the sort of amplitude of this spiral going in is decaying exponentially in time, not as a power law in time. So there's no scale invariance in that sense. Anything else?
Can I give two other suggestions about...
Okay.
GBF theorem.
GBF.
Hamiltonian is bigger than in some systems, the free energy something.
I've never heard of that. I don't know what that is.
The Lyapunov exponent.
So that's now coming to like dynamical systems theory. Maybe. Let me think about it.
The black hole thermodynamics.
Oh my God. Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I don't think so. Okay, I'm done with the slide for now. Thank you. Okay. Okie doke. So, in the spirit, please just ask away.
How did you look at that equation and said, "Oh, that's a closed orbit equation"?
How did I know that? Well, you know, some of this just come. Well, first of all, you know, people, you know, almost 100 years ago figured that out. But the point here is that when you're dealing with nonlinear equations, every single set of equations has its own idiosyncrasy, how you might be able to get some analytical understanding of it. But the point here is that a really important clue is the fact that appears in both terms on the right side, B appears in both terms on the right side in the two equations, and it naturally suggests, like looking at log A and log B, that they're quantities. And then it's not very hard once you've looked at log A dot and log B dot that it seems like that there's a conservation law.
I mean, because you wrote the formula log of AB dot minus A plus B dot, this is closed orbit.
Well, the log AB dot plus minus log plus A plus B dot equals zero, which means that combination of variables is conserved.
Okay. Yeah, but what is that? Is that closed orbit?
Yes.
I mean, how can I make the connection by just looking at the formula?
No. So, I mean, again, there was one other piece to it that locally around the fixed point, we saw that the orbits were going around and, you know, they're going around. And the point is that if there's a conservation law, that means when I make one turn around the orbit, that because there is this conserved quantity, that means that the combination of variables has to come back to its same value at the end of one orbit. So it's very much like the Runge lens vector in classical mechanics. And if you don't know what the Runge lens vector is, you know, it's like, it's not obvious. It sort of comes out of nowhere. Like, who thought of this? And, you know, people very clever looked at these equations of motion, said, aha, there is a conservation law hidden in these equations, and was able to infer. And then from that, we saw the orbits are closed. But it went the other way around, which is as people notice the orbits are closed, and the conservation of angular momentum only says the orbits have to lie in a plane. So there must be some other conservation law. So people went looking for it. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about, and this is perhaps more relevant for our time today, is epidemic models. And so some of these you might have even read about in the newspaper. And so there's two basic types of epidemic models. There's so-called SIS model, which is susceptible, infected, susceptible. So this describes what might, you know, like the annual flu or the common cold, which is that, you know, we're all susceptible to getting a cold. All of us at some point will get a cold, and all of us will recover from the cold and be susceptible to getting the cold again. So that's why it's called susceptible, infected, susceptible, because once you've had the infection, you can still be reinfected. And then there's the SIR model, which is susceptible, infected. And then for this guy, you can either say recovered, say if it's measles, allegedly you can only get measles once in your life, or chicken pox, unless you get shingles when you're really old, or it could be fatal, in which case you could call this population removed, like smallpox, you know, some fraction of people die from it. And so let's try and figure out the dynamics of these types of models. And so when COVID first hit, I mean, people were using SIR type models to try and analyze this. And so first of all, we'll analyze just the SIS and classic SIS and SIR models, and then we can think a little bit about like what one does for things like COVID. Okay, so again, this is based on the perfect mixing assumption so that there's no notion that there's like localized regions where there's more infection somewhere else. It's just that the local density is the same as a global density everywhere. And so we're going to write down equations for, so I'm going to call now S the density of susceptible, I the density of infected, R the density of recovered or removed, and write down differential equations for these things and figure out like the dynamics in that way. So first let's look at the SIS model. So how does S change, the susceptible changes? Well, you are no longer susceptible if you get sick. And the rate at which you get sick, well, I don't get sick spontaneously. If one of you has a cold and sneezes on me, then I might catch a cold. And you haven't sneezed on me yet. And so this is basically minus ki times s. So this describes an interaction where somebody who's infected gives a cold to somebody who's susceptible, and so that's going to correspond to the loss of people who are susceptible. And so K here is sort of a basic infection rate, which says that when two people come together, one who's infected and one who is susceptible, the rate at which the susceptible person is actually going to get sick. But then, so that's all that happens. And then the thing is that after some time, you get better. And so once you're better, you become susceptible again. And so there's a recovery rate times being infected. And similarly for infected, so we're going to have plus KIS minus RI. So you, if you, the time rate of change of the number of infected people. So if you're susceptible, this is the rate at which you're converted to being sick. But then if you're sick, you recover at some rate I, and so that's the dynamics. The first trivial point here is that obviously S plus I dot is equal to zero. And that's just a statement of conservation of the population. We have a fixed population of people. You're either susceptible or you're infected, and so the total number of people doesn't change with time. So that's no big deal.
R could be also removed.
No, R is this, that's in the SIR model. Wait 10 minutes. We'll come to the SIR model. But I'm just using the conventional notation that appears in textbooks. So we usually use little r. That's not the removed population. That's the recovery rate. Okay. So because S plus R is equal to zero, that means that S plus I is a conserved quantity, and we can choose to use our units in such a way that this is equal to one. So let's choose our unit so that the total density is equal to one. And so that allows us then to like eliminate one of the variables from here. So let's look at I dot. So it's equal to K I, 1 minus I, minus R I. And so that's going to give me K minus R I minus K I squared. And this is nothing more than the good old logistic model in disguise, because it's like I dot is linear in I minus quadratic in I. And so first point is that in order for there to be any epidemic at all, we need, so for K less than R, there's no epidemic at all. If I recover quicker than you can infect me, then, you know, there'll be no infection, there'll be no epidemic. Whereas for K larger than R, there is an epidemic. And that's just, you know, if this is negative, that means that, so for K larger than R, I'm plotting as a function of I dot, we have something that looks like that for K larger than R. Whereas for K less than R, it's just doing something like that, I dot as a function of I. And so the dynamics is just nothing.
Were S and I fractions of the society?
Pardon me?
S and I were
fractions, yes. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So the SIS model is just this. It's just the good old logistic model in disguise. So let's look at now the SIR model, which is more interesting. Got a lot more meat to it. So it's SIR. And so let's write down equations that describe the dynamics according to the fact that once you're recovered, you are no longer susceptible to the population. So now we have three components of the population. We have the susceptible, we have the infected, and we have the removed or recovered, depending on whether you want to be an optimist or a pessimist. And so S dot minus KIS and let's see what, so once, the point here is that once you are, if you're susceptible, once you get sick, you're either going to stay sick or you're going to become removed. So there's no gain term of susceptibles. The number of susceptibles disappears from the population. That's in some sense why epidemics in this SIR type formulation eventually disappear. If we think about the indigenous people who lived in this country, after the Spaniards came and brought smallpox with them, the population went down by 90%. But then it stopped. Like at some point, there was nobody left who was susceptible. So there's no other term here. But now we have here, we have plus K I S. Minus R I. Just the same as before. I can be infected by somebody who's susceptible, and at some rate I recover, but then the recovery is going into this population, R I. And again, we can choose our units such that S plus R, S plus I plus R is equal to 1, because if we add these up, clearly when we add these up, we get S dot plus I dot plus R dot equals 0, which means that S plus I plus R equals a constant, and we can choose a constant equal 1. So what we're measuring then is the fraction of population in each of these categories. So that's the SIR model dynamics. So it turns out that this is, you know, that little twist to the model that I allow for the possibility of people who are recovered changes the character of the model in a fundamental way. So here I'm sort of forgetting what I wanted to say here. So let me cheat a little bit. So the first point is this term here, because it's negative on the right-hand side, that means that S dot is always decreasing. This guy here, because it's a positive term, the number recovered is always increasing. So as an epidemic proceeds, there are just more and more people who are recovered from it, so always increasing. Whereas the sign of this term, it could be either positive or negative. So if this term is positive, that means that more people are getting sick every day, which is like when you see in the newspaper, that's when people start panicking. There's more people sick today than there were yesterday. And so increasing sort of corresponds to growing epidemic. On the other hand, it is possible that it could also decrease. So when it's decreasing in time, then people are starting to breathe easy because all the number of people getting sick is getting less each time. So it kind of means that the epidemic is ebbing. And so what I want to do now is like look at the dynamics of this process. One thing I should say, though, is that if you think about something like COVID, which has been, you know, a real drag, what made it really difficult is that, you see, a model of this type is what's sometimes called a compartment model. There's these three different compartments, SIR. But in COVID, there's another compartment, which is people who are infected, they don't have any symptoms. And so if you allow the possibility that there are people who are infected but without any symptoms, then, you know, so this, or it's called the SEIR model, susceptible, exposed, infected, recovered. And the problem is that this exposed population is very dangerous because they don't know that they're sick, but they're sick and they're actually making other people sick and they feel perfectly fine. And then you can have all different variations. You could have, and so people have made very complicated multi-compartment models. And the problem with these nonlinear differential equations is that basically you can get anything you want as you add more compartments. And one other aspect which I find extremely fascinating, I actually spent some effort on unsuccessfully, is that if you look at the history of epidemics in various countries and just look at it as a function of time, like how many people are infected, you'll see epidemic waves. And how do you describe epidemic waves in a system of first-order equations? Well, it's a little bit hard to begin with because first-order equations don't naturally lend themselves to oscillatory behavior. But if you have enough compartments, then you can get oscillatory behavior. And it turns out that in most countries, the oscillations are completely crazy in their amplitudes. Sometimes the third wave is bigger than the second wave, sometimes the seventh wave is the biggest, sometimes the fourth wave is the biggest. And in all of these sorts of compartment-like models, typically you get the behavior of successive waves is systematic as a function of time. So one thing which is still open, very open, is like, is there some kind of a simple idealized model that allows you to describe epidemic waves that actually have any connection with reality? And I don't know if it's even possible. But it's like, that's a fundamental issue here in modeling COVID. Okay. But let's leave COVID behind here, and let's just talk about the simpler case of just good old SIR. So from this observation, I can define an epidemic condition. Which is when I dot is growing as a function of time. And so I dot is growing as a function of time. So I dot greater than zero. And that implies that KS minus R is greater than zero. So this guy, you can think of as the input rate to the, you know, because that's the left-hand side of this equation. This is the rate at which people are being converted to infected. And this is the rate at which they're being converted to recovered. So this is like the input rate to infected to I. And this is the output rate. And so the epidemic condition is just that when the number of people getting infected each day is more than the number of people recovering, then things are bad. Okay. So let's try and use some mathematics to determine the epidemic severity. So let me... Yeah. So let's see, what do I want to do here? Yeah, so the thing is that, you know, again, these are like differential equations as a function of time. And, you know, I'm not sure I know who thought of this, but it just turns out that oftentimes it's better to like look in a parametric formulation of this problem. And the thing here is let's look not at these things as a function of time, but the number of infected as a function of S. So let's take these two equations and basically divide them. So I'm going to take I dot and divide by S dot, and let's see what comes out. So we're going to take I dot and divide it by S dot, and let's see what comes out of that. So I dot, so we have AIS minus RI, and then I divide that thing by S dot, which is minus KIS. And so that gives me minus 1 plus R over K, 1 over S. So this is going to be DI by DS. And for later simplicity, let me define this thing to be minus 1 plus R bar. So I'm just using a conventional notation that it's in textbooks, R bar divided by S. And so what does this equation tell us? It says that, first of all, notice that like when the infection is bad, that means that I is increasing as S is decreasing. And you see the minus 1 here. So that says like if the number of susceptibles is large, like if everybody's susceptible, so this is like a small correction, this term is going to be close to minus 1. And so it says that as time goes on, as more people are getting infected, the number of susceptibles is going down, and so that's actually bad. So that's describing the condition, the epidemic condition, where I dot is positive. But as the epidemic continues on and either people are recovering or dying, whatever the case may be, eventually the number of susceptibles, which is the engine that keeps the epidemic going, gets smaller and smaller, and eventually this goes to zero, and that will then give me I dot equals zero, and when I dot becomes negative, that means that the epidemic is waning. So this equation actually tells us information about the dynamics of the epidemic. And so that's what I'm going to analyze after a break, starting right now. So I'll stop for 4 minutes. If you want to run out, fine. And I won't lecture. And if you want to ask questions, that's fine too.
So we have another exponent.
What?
For the 14th lecture.
Say again?
We have another exponent.
Oh, Lyapunov exponent.
Because
we had this condition here. I think Lyapunov might be revision. Yeah,
so mine was better.
Okay. No, I mean,
it's
really like Slavic surname,
which
I think.
Yeah.
So here, one over
S.
Lia
is just
like. Continuous thing.
Like it literally
blows up.
At S equals zero. Well, I mean, maybe I'm going to actually integrate this equation. We're going to get some answer from this, and you'll see there's nothing terrible that's going on.
You want to blame? I don't even know what you're talking about.
Just trying to drive the conversation.
You're about to imagine the rest. Sorry, can you explain the last point again? You said.
Which last point?
You said S goes to zero because after some time, and then the I D goes to infinity. So, what does that have anything to do with the fact that I dot goes to zero?
I seem to have lost a page. No, sorry. Let me panic for a second. Where did this go? Is there a piece of paper? Oh. Bizarre.
No, it's positive because S is always decreasing.
Oh, here it is. Okay, so sorry. All right, so ask your question again.
So if S goes to zero, the IDS goes to infinity.
Right.
Does that mean that I dot goes to zero?
Yes. Yeah, because it means that's the end of the epidemic. That means that there's nobody left who can, you know, that everybody's susceptible. There's nobody left who's infected. And when nobody's left who's infected, then. Well, bear with me, because like in 2 minutes, I'm going to derive something from this. And if your question remains after 2 minutes, then ask it again. Ask it again. Let me just put my notes in the right order now. But I found them. No, where's no? I'm,
what?
I'm just trying to answer my.
But the thing is, antiferromagnetic, I mean, it depends on whether you're talking about quantum or classical.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Quantum is very different.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yes, yes. Yeah, no, that, but that's in the quantum spin chains. That's a really different. Geez, I do have a missing page in notes. That is bizarre. Where did it go? No, geez. What? Okay. Now I think I have my notes in order. Geez. Don't do that to me. Okay. When you only have a few notes, it's very easy to put them in the wrong order. Okay. So, first point is notice that from this equation, dI by dS is equal to this quantity. So when dI dS equals zero, which says that, you know, like at the beginning of the epidemic, I is increasing with time. When the epidemic is ending, I is decreasing with time. And so somewhere in the middle, there's a point where I has reached its maximum. And so that's this condition. And this is kind of the condition for the maximum of the epidemic. And that happens when S is equal to this R bar. And again, if you go back over here, when S is equal to this R bar, that says that these two terms exactly balance. And so that's kind of like the peak of the epidemic. Initially, the epidemic is such that more people are getting sick per day than the previous day. When the epidemic is ending, fewer people are getting sick per day than yesterday. And so this defines the epidemic maximum. And then to find out the epidemic severity, let's integrate this equation and see what we can learn from it. So if I integrate this equation, so I'm going to have I of t minus I of 0. So I'm going to take the ds and put it on the right-hand side. So I have di is equal to minus ds plus r bar ds over s. So when I integrate di, I just get I of t minus I of 0, and that's equal to minus s of t minus s of 0. And then I have plus r bar log of s of t divided by s of 0. And so we can use this to determine something about the severity of the epidemic, because we can now look what happens at infinite time. So for t going to infinity, so at infinite time, by construction, there's no infected, there's no susceptible. And so what we get from this, so we're going to get minus I of 0 is equal to S of 0 plus R bar. Sorry, I know what I'm doing wrong here. So the thing is that at infinite time, nobody's sick, because that means the epidemic is over.
How did you know that?
Right. Well, in order for at the end of the epidemic, everything is not changing with time. So that means that I better be constant. S better be zero, because if there's any I in S, that means that I'm going to have some change. So it has to be that I at infinity is zero. And that's, yeah, okay.
Is that just a boundary condition?
Pardon me?
Is that just a boundary condition?
No, it's not a boundary condition, because I'm not imposing it from the outside. I'm just saying, on the basis of physical reality, that at the end of the epidemic, there's nobody who's infected, because if someone was infected, that means there would be some change in time. So at t goes to infinity, so I of infinity is zero minus I of minus I at zero. Why am I confused about this? Yeah, so the thing is that, I'm sorry. Yeah, so I should have a boundary condition, which is that at the initial time, by definition, I should have a population of infected and, a population of susceptible. Nobody's yet recovered, and then some small number of infected people. That allows the infection to proceed. So I'm sorry, I'm making myself confused, because I'm just give me a second here. Oh, yeah. So I'm sorry. I'm making this way more complicated than I need to. So, you know, whenever I'm stumbling like this, it means I'm doing something inherently stupid. So let me take this equation. Let me write it in the following. So let's forget about t is infinity. Let's just write it in the following way. So let me bring the s of t and I of t to the left-hand side. So I have s of t plus I of t. And that's equal to s of 0 plus I of 0. Plus r bar logarithm s of t, s of 0. Now, this guy is the total population initially, right? Because at the beginning of the process, there's nobody who is recovered yet. You either have susceptible people or infected people. So this thing is equal to 1. So that makes life a lot simpler. So now let's look at the limit t goes to infinity. So as t goes to infinity, by definition, there'll be nobody who's infected. So as t goes to infinity, so I'm going to get s infinity is equal to 1 plus r bar log s at t equals infinity divided by s 0. So this gives a condition then for like the extent of the pot of the infection, because it's telling us if this is like a transcendental equation for S infinity. So you can only solve it numerically. So from this, we infer what S infinity is. And S infinity, by definition, is equal to 1 minus I. The total number of people who got infected. And so this is a condition that tells you the extent of the epidemic. Like what, you know, like after COVID, you know, like, I don't know what the right, you know, what's the right example? Like measles. I mean, you know, I guess, but now there's measles, there's a measles, oh yeah, that's right, there is a measles vaccine. Like that didn't exist when I was a kid. So, you know, you either got it or you didn't. But the point here is that this tells you then like the extent of the epidemic, because you can then, but you see it's only numerical that you figure out like how, what is the fraction of people who are susceptible at the end of the day who will never get sick because there's nobody left to get, there's nobody infected to get you infected. Yes?
Is 2 awesome, infinity or R infinity? Because they didn't say that I infinity.
Oh, I'm sorry. Crap. Yes, thank you. Yeah, so at the end of the day, you have a population who are either recovered or susceptible, and the susceptible ones never get sick because there's nobody left to get sick. Thank you. Okay, so that's...
Why R bar the logarithm of S infinity over S naught is R? How did you find that?
No, the thing is that this you have to now solve for S infinity.
Yeah.
So this is some transcendental equation which one has to solve numerically. Once you have S infinity, then you can say, well, R infinity is 1, you know, is 1 minus S infinity. So it's not like R bar is this. Yeah, sorry, that does look a bit misleading. Okay, so that's what I have to say about epidemic type models. So the last thing that I want to present in this whole story of population dynamics is an example of what's called invasion dynamics. And this is the simplest example that I'm aware of in which you include some spatial variation in the densities. And so let's imagine the following situation. Imagine a population which is undergoing logistic growth, and so it's like, say, it's field mice, and they, if they come to a region, so, you know, they eat grass, and so, you know, if I have like an island which is homogeneously filled with field mice, there'll be some density of grass because the field mice eat the grass, and so that'll sort of limit the population. You have some steady state density. But now suppose I do the following thing. I go to a brand new island like Australia in 1750 whatever, and I introduce field mice at one corner where the, you know, the first settlers came or the first people brought their prison ships, and they release some field mice. And the field mice say, wow, here's Australia, look at this, there's all this grassland, you know, let's have a grand old time, let's eat the grass. And so the point is that this like wave of field mice will gradually infect or invade, or depending on your perspective, will gradually go across Australia until like the entire continent is filled with field mice. And so the question is, what is the dynamics of that process where like a wave of field mice is going through the system? And so the way that we try and describe that is we now imagine that there's a density of field mice, which is a function now of space and time. And we want to write the time derivative of this quantity. And to make the discussion as simple as possible, let me imagine that my space is a one-dimensional line. So Australia is a line. I introduce field mice at some point on the line. And gradually, because you know Australia is full of grass, it's very virgin territory that they can take over. And so they will do so. And so there'll be two terms that describe its dynamics. One is the rho times one minus rho term. And if I really want to be more careful, I could put like sort of some sort of growth rate, which is, you know, as a function of, you know, how quickly do the field mice reproduce as they eat grass. So this is just good old logistic growth. But let me also add plus d, the diffusion coefficient, times the second rho by the x squared. So I want to allow the possibility of diffusion also happening. Because, you know, the field mice, they're not very smart, and so they just wander randomly. And, you know, when they find grass, they eat it, but they don't run towards the grass. They're just randomly wandering around. And so this is the basic equation that describes the possibility of both some population dynamics and some transport. And it turns out this is a very famous equation in mathematical physics, and it was discovered and rediscovered multiple times. And so it used to be called the Fisher equation, and then it was realized by, oh, the Russians discovered it first, and so it was called the Fisher-Kolmogorov equation, and then it was realized that, but in fact, these other two guys found it before Kolmogorov, and so it's called the FKPP equation for Fisher, Kolmogorov, Piskunov, Petrovsky. So FKPP equation. FKPP. And if you remember the guy's name, it's good for you. So the thing is that this equation cannot be solved. It's a complicated nonlinear partial differential equation. In general, we can't solve that. But we can get some feeling for what's happening just by some very rudimentary analysis. And so here is the idea, which is that I'm looking as a function of, so here's rho xt, and here is x. So I introduce my field mice over here. There's virgin territory with lots of grass. And so this population of mice is going to sort of move to the right in some kind of a fashion like this. And the fundamental question here is, what is the velocity of that wave front? So the point is that here is rho equals 1. When it's rho equals 1, then the environment and the field mice are in balance with each other. The rate at which the grass is being produced and the rate at which they're eating it is such that you have a stable population of 1. So the stable population of 1 is invading this virgin territory of population 0. Or if you're thinking in terms of genetics, you can think of like a mutant species is invading a otherwise normal species. And so you can ask, like, how do the mutants take over population? So there's lots of scenarios where this kind of phenomenology occurs.
Is this a common time, constant time?
So this is like early time, you know, this is a time t1, this is a time t2, t3, where t3 is bigger than t2, bigger than t1. Okay, so how do we get anything out of this? And so the analysis I'm going to do here is extremely simple-minded, but oftentimes, like, simple-minded is the best. And so let's make an assumption for, it's weird, like, at the top of the board, it doesn't, assumption. let's make the following assumption. Rho x t is some amplitude. Well, actually, we don't need the amplitude because I'm going to set it equal to 1. And it's just going to be something like e to the minus lambda x minus vt. And let's just sort of, let me try and justify this assumption. First point, it's a function of x minus vt. And a function of x minus vt, by definition, is a traveling wave. So this is the traveling wave assumption. I'm going to assume a traveling wave. And the other point is that there's this unknown constant here, lambda, which is telling me how quickly this wave is decaying as a function of x. And so oftentimes when you're dealing with wave-like phenomena, like what do you do when you have like a wave equation? You assume a wave-like solution, you plug it in, you play around a little bit, and you get something called a dispersion relation, which is a relation between the velocity and the wavelength of the wave. And so we're going to do the same thing here. We're going to plug in this assumption into our differential equation and get a dispersion relation, which relates the velocity of the wave to its wavelength, and see what we can get out of all of that. So let's substitute that into our differential equation. Substitute in FKPP, and let's see what comes out. So when I take derivative with respect to time, so here there's plus lambda v, and then times this exponential, which is going to be a common factor that I'm not going to worry about. Then on the right-hand side, there's two terms. Let me worry about the second term first because it's simpler. It's a linear function. And so when we take two space derivatives, we're going to get lambda squared. Now I have this term. It's a nonlinear term. And because it's nonlinear, that's what makes this problem like actually very difficult to solve. But the thing is that notice that this wave is exponentially decaying as a function of its argument. So when x is much larger than vt, the amplitude of the wave is necessarily very small. So let's just say, so I'm going to write approximately equal to, that for large x, let me neglect the nonlinear term. Unjustified assumption, but it's sort of a very natural assumption at the leading edge of the wave. So if I neglect that, I'm going to get plus k, and that's it. D. Thank you. That's here, D. Thank you.
Can you explain why this graph is correct? Basically, can you explain this graph why at greater times the rho decays?
Because in some sense, the stable state of the system is rho equals 1. And so what we're having is an invasion of the stable state into an unstable region. When rho is equal to 0, that's not stable. Because if I introduce any infinitesimal density of mice, it's going to suddenly grow to rho equals 1. So we're here, you know, at the leading edge of the wave, there's a tiny density of mice because there's the leading edge of the invasion of mice. And once there's any amount of mice, it's going to go to 1 because of this equation, because of the population term. If rho dot is infinitesimal, the growth rate is large, and so it's going to grow quite quickly at this point. And so we have this invasion of the stable state into the unstable region.
And why for greater time rho becomes 0 at greater x?
Well, so here we're just saying, you know, it's like I introduced mice in 1759 in Sydney, Australia. In Perth, Australia, which is 3,000 miles away, the mice haven't had a chance to get there yet. So there's a finite speed of propagation just because of the finite speed that the animals can move. And that's why, and that's because of this diffusion term. So, you know, if I was to do like the good old mean field assumption, which is I introduce mice in Sydney, Australia, and say, well, they're instantly perfectly mixed, and so the density is constant everywhere, then I wouldn't have any spatial variation. But this is what we want to look at.
Also, why is this assumption true? Because you only have one partial derivative with respect to t. If you had two partial derivatives, assuming a wave would have been correct, but this is not a wave equation.
No, that's right. It turns out to be a wave equation because of the presence of this term. But you know, but the thing is that like in undergraduate classes, you're exposed to like sound waves or like waves on a string and all of that. And then if you write down Newton's laws, you're going to get like a second order equation in time. But it doesn't have to be second order in time. I mean, the point about second order in time, that means that there's forward in time and backward in time mean the same thing. first order in time means that there's actually time reversal symmetry breaking. And that's what's happening here, because this wave only can propagate to the right. There's no possibility of propagating in the opposite direction.
I mean, I think this is a wave equation as much as the Schrodinger equation is the wave equation.
Right.
Because they're exactly, I mean, kind of the same.
So. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Is there a uniqueness thing here?
What do you mean uniqueness?
Like if is that the solution to your equation? Does this partial differential equation have uniqueness?
Well, you know, once you say, does the equation have a unique solution, that's sort of like coming into the realm of mathematics, which is to prove like there exists a solution or prove that the solution is unique. I have nothing to say about that. I mean, I'm just saying that based on sort of physical intuition, I expect that if I introduce a small density of mice at one end of this, you know, grassland, that there's going to be this invasion wave. And you know, sort of it's obvious to me that it's going to be unique, but I don't know how to prove it. Okay, so anyways, so we have this thing. And so I can write this that V is equal to d lambda plus k over lambda. So this is my dispersion relation. So this is a relation that relates the wavelength of the wave, which is somehow controlled by lambda, and the velocity. And now I leave the world of like trying to derive anything, and just it's almost a world of fantasy, which is like, so what wave, what is the speed of the wave? And so if I plot this velocity as a function of lambda, so you see that for large lambda, it grows. For small lambda, it blows up. So this is an upside down curve that looks something like this. And there is a V min. And you know, we can determine V min by differentiating this thing with respect to lambda. And so dV by d lambda gives me d minus k over lambda squared. K over lambda squared. Can you guys see that? No, not quite. Yeah. This is the middle one. Yeah. And so that says that lambda, critical value of lambda that minimizes thing is equal to k, lambda is equal to k over d. K over d. Oh, you can't. Only one of us could use that excuse. Anyway, and you plug it back into here, and so you're going to get here. This is k. This is lambda square root of k over d, and so here we're going to get dk square root, and this will be also dk square root. So that says that v star is equal to 2 dk square root. So there's this v min, which is twice dk square root. And so it turns out, and so, you know, it's like at this level, it turns out if you then do simulations of this process or do a numerical integration of this equation, you'll find that the wave propagates at exactly this minimum wave speed. And so people elevate this observation to what they call the velocity selection principle. That in fact, nature chooses the minimum speed to propagate. And there's no microscopic derivation of this, as far as I know. So it's kind of a cool thing that, you know, even at this level of simplicity, mystery still remains. So one of these is this velocity selection principle. So this is a very, you know, simple paradigmatic example. And, you know, one can only like chip away at the edges by making this linear approximation. But from this, we can get some understanding of like the rate at which a mutant species propagates into an otherwise, you know, undisturbed environment.
What happens is that, for example, the case of the mice that you talked about, the velocity of the diffusion would be always the minimum?
Yes. Yeah. And so, and people see this also in like experiments of that somehow the minimum velocity is selected out of all the possibilities that exist.
Why is the minimum velocity not zero? Like the mice is not moving.
No, but the thing is that according to the dynamics of the process, I mean, you know, the mice want to move here because, you know, where, you know, the last mouse where the density is small, because of this term here, that means that their population is going to grow very quickly. And when the mice are like here at one, that means that their density is not going to change very much. So the point is that the propagation to the right is happening because at the leading edge of the wave, you know, the mice are growing very rapidly here. They're growing less rapidly here. So this gradually gets filled in. And then here, there's a mouse, a leading edge that then grows. And that's why it's propagating to the right.
So the lazy nature principle?
Yeah, something like that. What can I tell you? So that's the end of my whole presentation of population dynamics. And now the course is going to turn to some other phenomenological examples of non-equilibrium processes that, and I've chosen two for the last two topics of the class, as I've just described it so far, that again, I think are paradigmatic, very beautiful mathematics, and very beautiful phenomenology. And so the first example that I want to present along those lines is aggregation kinetics. So first of all, what is aggregation? That refers to the irreversible growth of clusters by clusters sticking together to make larger clusters that then make even larger clusters. So there are two examples that we're all familiar with. One is gelatin. You know, do you guys ever have Jell-O?
It's not kosher.
Well, there is a kosher version of it. Yeah, but you know, do people know what gelatin is? But so, you know, the point is that you take like your gelatin powder, you mix it with water, you stir it up, you stick it in the fridge, and lo and behold, it comes out as this different phase of matter. It's no longer liquid. It's a semi-goopy, ugh. I could tell you a story about my mother at some point. But anyways, so the thing is, what has happened there is that your gelatin molecule are multifunctional molecular units. So what you can think of is like some molecule that looks something like this. And these are grabby arms. These are like Velcro at the ends of these things. And so you have these multifunctional units with Velcro at the end of them. And so when two pieces of Velcro come together, they will join up and make something even bigger. And then the bigger it gets, the more grabby arms this piece of molecule has, and it just continues to aggregate until it makes something that spans the entire system, and you have change from a liquid phase to a gel phase. So that's one example. Another one is gravitational aggregation. We live in a solar system, but you know, where did that come from? It came because of gravitational accretion of matter, and you've seen all kinds of, I'm sure, like science fiction stories or movies or simulations where clouds of dust accrete and make stars and make planets. And so gravitational aggregation is another example. So the two natural examples are gelation and gravitational accretion. And so the idea I want to try and present, that sort of, excuse me, the physical scenario is that I have a cluster of mass I, a cluster of mass J, and they come together at some rate that it depends on their masses, Kij. So this Kij is what's called the reaction rate or the reaction kernel. And depending, it could depend on I and J, it may not depend on I and J, but there's some rate at which this I-mer and J-mer convert to an I plus J-mer. So the outcome of all of this is that these guys make some bigger cluster of size I plus J. So this is the phenomenon that I want to describe mathematically. Once I have a gas, some initial state of the system, whatever it's going to be. And by the way, another example of this is, let's put rain. It's another natural example because, you know, clouds are bubbling up and there's updrafts, and then you have little, you know, water vapor that accretes into larger droplets, and the droplets get larger and larger. Eventually, they can no longer be held up by the updrafts of the atmosphere, and they fall down as rain. And so that's another natural example. So the goal here is to understand the time evolution of the distribution of cluster sizes. So basic observable. Basic observable is what I'll call CK of T. This is defined as the density of clusters of mass K at time T. So that's the goal that I want to of what I'm going to follow in the next couple of lectures is to actually calculate this cluster size distribution for specific models of the reaction rate. So given a reaction rate, we can write down equations for the evolution of the cluster size distributions and then attempt to solve them. So that's going to be the goal of next lecture. So the last thing I just want to say for today is that this whole description is based on a lot of assumptions. So let me sort of put the assumptions right out there at the front because they're important to mention. First point is this sort of perfect mixing assumption. So maybe I should put here assumptions. Perfect mixing. So I'm assuming that there's no spatial variation, so the density of clusters of size k is the same throughout the entire universe. And, you know, so you could think of like when you're making your gelatin, you're stirring up the bowl all the time. That's not so unreasonable. In a gravitational situation, that's obviously doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's at least a reasonable starting point. Another thing that we're assuming here is bimolecular interactions only. Bimolecular interactions only. So I'm not allowing the possibility of three clusters to come together simultaneously and make something. So in some sense, you can imagine that this assuming that the density is small. Low density. Another very important assumption here is that no shape variables, or no shape. That is that the rate at which two clusters come together depend only on their masses and not on whether like they're long skinny sticks or spheres or anything like that. So we're throwing away all shape degrees of freedom. So we're assuming that each cluster is characterized by its mass and only its mass and nothing else. So the way to make this concrete is you can think of it's like droplets with a surface tension. So every time that you come together and make a larger droplet, it immediately converts to a sphere of a larger radius. And so you just have symmetrical spheres. And so then the only thing that characterizes it is its mass and nothing else. I think there's one more assumption, and I've forgotten it. Yes. And the last thing here is there's no discreteness. And so what I mean by this is that I imagine that my system is so large that if I ask for what is the density of clusters of mass 17, that'll be the number of clusters of mass 17 divided by the total number of clusters in the entire universe. But there's never the possibility that the number of clusters of a given size could be zero, because no matter, you know, if my system is infinite in extent, there's no notion of finiteness. So that turns out to be useful, or it simplifies things greatly. So under these assumptions, what I'm going to do next time is I'm going to write down a differential equation for the distribution or the evolution of the cluster size distribution. And then what we're going to do is solve it. So that'll be for next time. And so the thing that we'll see is like how the cluster size distribution evolves in time, and we'll learn some interesting phenomenology about aggregation kinetics. So I guess that's until next Monday. Yes?
So in the lectures, we study that at the critical temperature, if we change the correlation end, the system does not change. But at less than or greater than the critical temperature, it changes scale.
Mm-hmm.
But why does that happen? Why, if at the critical temperature, we have scale invariance? If we could, like, understand that in the experiment.
Well, so, you know, again, what I would say is that, you know, at a second order phase transition, one has all scales participating in the phenomenology. So if I'm thinking about percolation, because that's simpler to think about. So you have an infinite cluster, but it's very ramified in its structure. And it's such that when I rescale, it looks exactly the same. So I tried to show those slides where I was showing it when I squished and then kept squishing that the picture would look the same. So this feature of scale invariance happens only at the critical point, because if I'm above the critical point, I will renormalize to P equals 1 or 0 temperature. And if I'm below the critical point, I will renormalize to P equals 0 or infinite temperature. It's only at the critical point where all scales are participating, from the size of this room to the size of the universe in principle, that the system is scale invariant. So I'm not sure I'm answering. I mean, it's almost maybe I'm doing a tautology, and that you're saying, well, so why is the scale invariant? I'm just saying that the scale invariant, because that's a definition of a second order phase transition. The transition between two phase states which are not scale invariant, either below the critical point or above the critical point, there's a loss of scale invariance. What I mean by that is that, you know, there'll be scale invariance up to a characteristic size scale, and then at some point you'll see that in fact, oh, I'm really below the critical temperature, I'm above the critical temperature, because it'll be a finite maximum cluster size. And if I renormalize beyond that finite maximum cluster size, I will renormalize to the endpoints of either zero temperature or infinite temperature. But at the critical point, no matter how often you rescale, the system looks exactly the same at every single scale. And so I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
I don't understand exactly why the critical point is so important in terms of being scale invariant.
Well, you know, what to say about that? You know, like, I kind of agree with you. Like, why are we always just looking at the critical point? And part of the reason we're looking at the critical point, only one point in the phase diagram, is because of this feature of scale invariance. So, you know, again, before the whole renormalization group theory was developed, and people always use perturbation theory to try and understand many-body systems. And perturbation theory is fundamentally flawed at dealing with scale invariant phenomena, because it basically means you have to include every single term in the perturbation series. And so a renormalization group was invented as a way to try and understand the behavior near a critical point that was not perturbative in its nature, but somehow built into it the scale invariance, which was the tool that you used to try and understand the critical point exponents. And the other thing was that because the critical point exponents were independent of details of the system, that was considered really cool and very deep and very powerful. And so understanding this universal behavior was one of the goals of the renormalization group calculations. Does that help? Okay. Yeah.
Do you get scale invariance for dynamical systems, or only like equilibrium?
Well, so there is scale invariance for dynamical systems. So one can think about what are called so-called non-equilibrium phase transitions. Like one example that I'm familiar with is something called the contact process. So in the contact process, you imagine you have particles in a one-dimensional line, and particles can die just at some rate, and a particle can give birth only if it has a neighbor next to it. So, you're on time, but the thing is that there's no lecture after me, so I'm just answering a bunch of questions. You can erase, you come in and erase while I'm talking. So anyways, in this contact process, if there's a critical density, above which there's an active phase, because you always have a neighbor that helps allow particles to give birth. But below a critical density, nothing happens. And so right near this critical point, there are large-scale temporal fluctuations where the density can go up and down, and there's like correlations in the temporal and spatial densities. So there is this same sort of scale invariance in a time, in a temporal phase transition. So that's the simplest example I'm aware of. Anything else?
Is there anything on the normalization subject that could be taught in the lecture?
Well, I mean, I guess the only other example that I would say that I would present that's kind of the one lecture-ish thing is the central limit theorem. Because have you guys seen the central limit theorem?
Yeah.
Some yes, some no. Okay. So, I mean, that's an example of renormalization. And the point here is that, so let me tell you what the statement of the central limit theorem is. If you have any kind of a random walk process, it doesn't matter what it is. It can be hopping 17 steps to the right half the time and, you know, 34 steps to the left a quarter of the time and 68 an eighth of the time, whatever it is. The point is that whatever microscopic rule you choose, if I wait in a large time, long distance limit, that distribution will go to a Gaussian, independent of all details. And that's a beautiful example of renormalization and universality, that the distribution in this long time limit is the same form, independent of all microscopic details. So I'm prepared to give that lecture right this second, because it's really beautiful. So I'm happy to do that. So I can stick that in somewhere. Okay. All right. Good.
Would that be an hour and a half lecture?
No.
How long would it be?
No, I mean, if it's less than an hour and a half, you would probably also talk about
Lyapunov exponents.
Yeah, I mean, she says Lyapunov.
Well, okay, but you obviously know how to pronounce it better than I do, because
it's like one point.
It's one what?
Sound, yeah.
La. Okay, so even though there's an L Y A.
Soft L, you know, like it's not la. Yeah. And like we know that it's like soft a way to do it, but when it's in English, people always have this like I or Y.
Right.
But then for it in another way, it two sounds. So it's.
I see. So it's properly. So you'll have to teach me the right way to pronounce the L. Okay. And then. And then I'll tell you about the output of exponent. Okay, I'll try and do that. Okay, anything else?
Chaotic systems too.
Chaotic systems. Well, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, here I'm going to cheat because I actually have a recorded course on dynamical systems theory. So I could share a few of these slides, and so, but yeah, I'll do that. Okay, I'll do that. I'll talk about. I'm afraid to say because I'm going to mispronounce the Lyapunov exponents.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll have something to say about central limit theorem and the dynamical systems theory at the end. Okay. Very good. All right. So have a great weekend.